Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Blue whales are the largest mammals on Earth. Dolphins are among the smartest. Add their respective skills in sonar, and you've got some promising recruits for the U.S. Navy. Decades after the Navy discovered that the sonar expertise of these cetaceans was superior to any military capability, the nature of how the Navy used these creatures is finally coming to light. In his latest book, War of the Whales, Joshua Horwitz reveals the unknown backstory of the Navy's acoustic warfare program and the challenges made to those practices in court. In an excerpt from the book, published at Outside Magazine Online, Horwitz writes about the origins and goals of the Navy's Marine Mammal Research Program. Joshua, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Nice to be here, Virginia.
Now, the excerpt in Outside details the Navy's use of marine mammals as test subjects and even as weaponry. This began with one man's obsession with bats. Tell us a little bit about the origins of these experiments.
Well, it was not until 1941 in a basement lab in Harvard University Biology Department that a young undergraduate, actually, who had had a lifelong obsession with bats, was able to prove for the first time that bats echolocate in the dark using sound, ultrasonic sound, which had never been audible to human hearing, but because of new technology with transistored electronics, they were able to finally prove that and solve a centuries-old zoological mystery about how they navigated and hunted in the dark. And that same scientist was quickly recruited by the Navy, the Office of Naval Research, after the war to investigate what other mammals, and speculate on what other mammals might use sound to navigate in the dark. And the prime suspect was whales, because they, of course, live in a very dark ocean. And it had always been mysterious how they hunted and migrated in these dark oceans.
So from that, this knowledge of echolocation among some mammals came the notion of creating bat bombs. What was the thinking behind that, and what is it ever used in active combat?
The bat bombs were actually not sound-based. Their idea was to sow incendiary bombs in the chest of bats, take them up en masse in cages, essentially, and unleash them from bombers above Tokyo and other cities, and have them nest inside the eaves of wooden buildings. And then these fused incendiary bombs would go off and burn down the cities. And they actually tested this in the desert. And the problem was that the bats didn't just go there. They flew wherever they wanted, including to army bases and whatnot. So that was scuttled, and they eventually ended up using traditional incendiary bombs.
What a story. But on to the sea mammals, really the nature of your book, which launched the Navy's Marine Mammal Research Program. This was in 1961, if I've got that right.
Right.
How was the Navy using dolphins and whales at that time?
Well, they heard rumors. They went down to Marineland Aquarium, which was the first marine park in America, down in St. Augustine, Florida, where there had been reports that these dolphins, who people were seeing up close for the first time, were making a lot of noise. And again, based on the speculation that small cetaceans as well as large ones might use biosonar to echolocate in the dark, the Navy sent its best scientists, which were at the time not marine mammalogists, because that discipline did not exist until the Navy created it, but they sent down zoologists and bioacousticians to study these animals, and they were able to deduce through a series of experiments using plexiglass walls and blindfolds and various other techniques to establish that, in fact, these animals did echolocate. And not only did they echolocate, but they echolocated with much more precision than the Navy's own sonar could accomplish. So these animals could tell the difference between ball bearings of infinitesimal different sizes. They could tell a zinc plate from a copper plate. They could find objects buried in the mud and the ocean floor. And so the Navy really became obsessed with the concept of reverse engineering that biosonar and incorporating that technology into their own sonar systems as well as training the dolphins to do various combat missions such as mine clearing and harbor patrol and other things that utilize their biosonar talents.
How did that work, the training cetaceans to become these kind of seagoing sentries or even delivering weapons?
Well, one of the interesting aspects of the story is that the Navy, of course, knew nothing about dolphins and small whales. It wasn't just dolphins, actually. They also trained beluga whales and orcas and pilot whales, as well as seals and other pinnipeds, which is a different branch of the marine mammal world. In any case, they had observed them in marine parks as being highly trainable, so that was the genesis of the idea, but they didn't know how to train them. They didn't even know how to keep them alive in artificial environments like tanks. So after losing their first captured dolphins to all sorts of illnesses, they recruited the curator of Marineland to come run their program out in California. So there's always been a very integral tie between the marine parks to this day and the Navy, first in terms of recruiting trainers and veterinarians, and subsequently when the Navy had a surplus of animals, they would lease them back or give them back to SeaWorld or other marine parks. And so there's been this symbiotic relationship going all the way back. And they were very successful eventually in training these animals to do, for instance, they can tell the difference between a decoy mine and a real mine, which is very valuable if you're trying to sweep a minefield where only 1 in 10 mines is real. So they use them in Vietnam for minesweeping, but also for harbor patrol in Da Nang. To try to interdict enemy swimmers, and they are quite effective at it. And in fact, we continue to use, those were what are called black ops, those were classified operations that were not public at the time. But today, we're still deploying militarized dolphins or trained Navy dolphins in the Persian Gulf.
We're talking about the Navy's acoustic warfare program. That was something that they used whales and dolphins to learn from, to mimic, and to deploy as weapons. Joshua Horowitz is with us. His book is called The War of the Whales. This is just such a fascinating aside here. Now, this is not the first time animals had been used in warfare. Can you give us a brief summary of how they've been used in the past?
Well, we've always we humans have deployed animals in our service to war since Hannibal used before that. But Hannibal, of course, used elephants to get over the Alps. We've used dogs in war, of course. We've used bats, as I've described. We've used pigeons. Passenger pigeons have been an integral part of warfare in terms of, you know, communicating among troops. So this was nothing new to use animals. What was new here is this idea of reverse engineering their talents to create technology. And what I discovered is that the Navy has spent decades trying to create dolphin drones, essentially, that if you look at them are very dolphins looking in shape and size, and they are equipped with side scan sonar, which is the kind of sonar that the dolphins use, and they have cameras and whatnot. But despite all their decades of research and development, these dolphin drones can't really touch what the dolphins themselves can do. Mm. And so they only work in very simple, like flat-bottomed ocean environments, which are very rare, actually.
Well, that was later in the 80s when they were trying to develop these kind of bionic dolphins. But earlier, another piece of history that you uncovered that could only belong to the Cold War, a fear of a dolphin gap between the U.S. and Russia. What was going on there?
Well, initially, the dolphin program was kind of it was a sideshow in the Navy, and they were just trying to, you know, learn what they could about these animals and see what they, you know, even including their hydrodynamics, how they move through the water so easily with very little drag, and they were using that to design missiles and torpedoes and even submarines. But when the CIA discovered in the mid to late 60s that the Russians had their own dolphin program in the Crimea in Sevastopol, which was recently in the news, they kicked it into high gear. Congress quadrupled their funding and this training program's funding, and it all went dark in terms of, you know, became heavily classified and remained so throughout the Cold War because they were worried that there would be a dolphin gap in the Cold War and that the Russians would have more advanced dolphin military assets than we would.
After all of these examples of using whales and dolphins as instruments of war that you write about, you point out also that scientific research by the Navy has actually helped transform our knowledge of whales and dolphins and supported in a way they're coming to mean something different, you know, in our culture, to symbolize something different. Could you just tease that apart?
The reason I wrote this book is that this story is just rife with ironies, many of them tragic and some of them just surprising. For instance, there was no scientific discipline of marine mammal, what's now called marine mammalogy or whale research, didn't exist before the Navy created it. So they recruited neurologists and zoologists and psychologists and psychoacousticians and all sorts of disciplines to create this new discipline. And most of what we know about whales has derived from Navy-funded research. And the problem that's created is that this generation of scientists are indebted to the Navy for their livelihood. So when this eventually ended up in the courts, it was very difficult for the conservationists to find expert witnesses who are willing to testify against their employer, essentially. But one of the other ironies that's buried in the story is that a few critical Navy-funded whale researchers, including a guy named John Lilly, who some people may remember from the 60s and 70s, he was really the person who conceived of many of the ideas for the whole strategy behind the Navy's Marine Mammal Research and Training Program. And he set up his own largely Navy-funded research program in the Caribbean to look at their communication, because he was captivated by the idea of our communicating with these animals and having the first real cross-species communication. But he sort of went off the deep end as a researcher and got very involved with these animals personally, was in the end dropping LSD, first dosing them and then taking LSD alongside them in tanks. And in any case, he decided that these animals were unfit for captive research, and he liberated his research animals and became one of the fathers of the Save the Whale movement. Mm. And there were other Navy-funded scientists who did the same. So it's just, again, one of the ironies of the story that these forces that collided in the 90s in the court really were both born out of this Navy passion for this biotechnology.
Now, Joshua, it's a fascinating and much larger story. I really want to thank you for sharing just a glimpse of it with us.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure being here.
Joshua Horowitz is a Washington, D.C.-based writer. He's also co-founder and publisher of Living Planet Books. His latest book is called War of the Whales, and you can read an excerpt for yourself on Outdoor Magazine's website. There's a link to find it at wordofmouthradio.org. The complexities of replicating cetacean sonar has confounded humans for decades. But what happens when the species itself can't replicate it? We get the story of the world's loneliest whale after the break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Because ocean particulates scatter light and smell isn't particularly effective underwater, marine mammals depend on sound to communicate in and sense their aquatic environment. Whales are capable of creating beautiful and unique vocalizations, often referred to as songs. So what happens if a whale sings at a different frequency than its peers? That is a question that scientists have been asking for decades. Producers Craig Shank and George Drake Jr. report.
It's a sound that has sparked curiosity and speculation around the world.
In the 1980s, I think it was, a recording was made of a whale that was unusual.
It's a sound distinctive from other whale vocalizations heard before or since.
Some physical abnormality in its sound production, maybe akin to a human with a lisp.
It's a sound that's believed to be a single whale that vocalizes at a unique frequency, 52 hertz. 52 hertz is close to the bottom range of what most humans can hear. The audio was actually sped up 10 times to make it easier to decipher.
In the years since the signal was first heard and tracked, 52 hertz has been nicknamed the world's loneliest whale. because some people assume that other whales can't hear or understand it. Although there's been no visual confirmation of 52 Hz, scientists are fairly sure that it's a whale.
There are characteristics to the signal. Even though the frequency is off of what you would expect, the signal type is of a whale call. My name is Darlene Ketten, and I am a joint appointment between Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Harvard Medical School.
The sound has been recorded in an area of the North Pacific where whales are often found. And those characteristics that she mentioned, they are distinctive from other sounds, like fish or boat propellers.
It is not impossible that it's something else mimicking a whale call structure, but so far we don't know of any underwater minor birds that would be doing that.
Most people are aware that marine mammals use sound to communicate, but we often don't think about how critical those sounds can be underwater.
Because they're dealing with an environment in which light doesn't penetrate well, most of the communication that goes on is likely to be purely acoustic, purely through sound.
But even if we recorded every single sound that whales make, we still wouldn't have an idea of what they're communicating until we could associate those sounds with the whale's behavior.
We need to be able to see what the animals are doing and record sounds from enough animals over a long enough period of time to tie it back to that activity.
So to get that visual information, just follow the signal and find the whale. But one whale, Pacific Ocean.
Well, the term needle in a haystack comes to mind.
This is Bruce Mate.
I am the director of the Marine Mammal Institute at the Hatfield Marine Science Center, Oregon State University in Newport, Oregon.
Bruce was asked to join a team trying to track down 52 Hz for a documentary project called Finding 52, The Search for the Loneliest Whale in the World.
And if they manage to find 52 Hz, the next step is to tag it for tracking, which isn't as simple as it sounds. First, they get in a rather unobtrusive boat.
A small, inflatable vessel.
They approach the whale slowly, as not to catch it off guard.
Alert the animal or make it startle.
And when they're close enough, they can put a tag on the whale.
The size of my ring finger and about the length of a ballpoint pen.
Which sounds pretty big, but to a whale, it's like a pinprick.
It's not that bad. And these tags can have different kinds of information about whales.
How much time is spent at different water depths, sometimes about physiological information like heart rate, vocalizations. We have some tags that have three-axis accelerometers in them where we can actually see a sperm whale lunging to grab squid or a baleen whale making a lunge to collect krill.
As we mentioned, much of what has been written about 52 Hz is focused on its loneliness or its supposed solitary nature. By tracking 52 Hz, we might learn that it's more like other whales than most people think. In fact, it's not all that unusual for whales to travel alone.
Amongst baleen whales, it is completely typical that the whales move as individuals. The fact that you find baleen whales clustered about in certain areas is more a product of why they are there.
It's entirely possible that 52 Hz ends up in those certain areas for things like feeding and reproduction. So the question is, if some whales are solitary by nature, how did 52 Hz become the world's loneliest whale?
I think it's easy to anthropomorphize animals in general, because giving them, I'll say, human attributes is comfortable for us. That's what we know best.
In other words, people make assumptions about animal behavior that may be based primarily on their own emotions without fully understanding the behavior itself.
Perhaps reflecting on an animal with a very unique vocalization pattern, we think about that as being lonesome, but I'll be honest, I pretty much doubt that when it comes to reproductive behavior or feeding, that that's going to be any kind of a handicap.
In the case of 52 Hz, discovery has helped drive curiosity. Although it may have led to an unscientific narrative, it has still helped generate interest and enthusiasm for this unique whale. But public interest in science can be a balancing act between what we tell ourselves and what the science actually tells us.
While it's a great idea to convey information about science in a way that makes people animated and more interested in the topic, is good. What you don't want to do, though, is to encourage speculation and or extrapolations without applying that rigor of logic.
Although the science points to the lonely whale scenario being unlikely, perhaps that original spark of interest towards the 52 Hertz whale shouldn't be abandoned.
Frankly, where sound was what started the interest, sound is what's going to draw us in to find the animal, and it won't surprise me if what we see is something we're pretty familiar with. It just sounds unusual.
I'm Craig Shank.
And I'm George Drake Jr.
And that production is part of the STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation and presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Stay with us after the break. Smile, your mug is being tracked by surveillance cameras you may not even know exist. We're going to talk to a journalist who tried to thwart facial recognition software, ironically, by making himself stand out in a crowd. We'll learn his tricks after the break.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Since last year, when the extent of the NSA's electronic monitoring was revealed, we've heard an awful lot about protecting ourselves from surveillance society. There are ways to protect privacy on your phone, emails, and web searches, but short of wearing a mask, we can't hide from the multiple cameras and facial recognition software that track far more of our lives than most of us would like to admit. Who would think that all you need is a little face paint? The Atlantic editor Robinson Meyer tried out CV Dazzle. That's a proposed method for camouflaging individual faces from surveillance technology. And Robinson found that while it may conceal you from cameras, it brings more attention to you from other human beings. He's here to tell us a little bit more about the experience. Rob, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, what does CV Dazzle aim to protect people from?
CV Dazzle, the CV stands for Computer Vision Dazzle. It's a kind of face paint you can put on your face. It's a set of patterns. It has a matching kind of hairdo. And it's meant to obscure your face from facial recognition algorithms of all kinds.
So when you'd still designed, be seen on camera, you just wouldn't be recognized.
Right. You still appear on camera. To certain algorithms looking for a pattern that looks like a human face, they would not recognize your face as meeting that pattern. Your face looks like any random collection of pixels. It's not face. You know, in the world of the algorithm, you have things that are face and things that are not face. And
you're
CV
just
Dazzle,
object.
Exactly.
So who came up with this?
It was come up with by a kind of artist designer named Adam Harvey, who's based in New York. And it was designed at first because Facebook was auto-tagging. Facebook, around 2009 or 2010, rolled out a feature where it would suggest you to tag other users in photos, your friends in photos. So when you uploaded a set of photos from your phone, it would say, hey, this looks like Robinson Meyer. Would you like to tag him as Robinson Meyer? And then show all his friends this photo. And to Adam Harvey, this was not good if, for example, you were going out. You had a big night planned, and then you didn't want pictures from that to be forever linked to your name on the internet. And so the original idea behind CV Dazzle, it was that you would put it on your face, and then you would, go out to clubs or whatever, and it would look kind of like a odd fashion statement, but it would not. Then when the pictures of you were uploaded later that night, Facebook or any kind of facial recognition software would not suggest that they be tagged as you in a social network.
So you wouldn't be tagged on your social network, but people would look at you like a freak for the entire evening.
Yes, exactly. Or, maybe very avant-garde, maybe very edgy.
Well, okay, so you didn't test it going out to bars. You commuted to work in Washington, D.C., and you painted your face yourself. Now, you said there are patterns available. Did you just do it with regular face makeup or face paint?
Yeah, I was getting more and more interested in it, particularly because it is if listeners go look for the pictures online, it's a very striking pattern, and it's kind of a cool pattern. So I was getting interested in kind of rolling it out beyond, hey, look what this cool set of patterns can do, and just wearing it around normal life and see how people responded. So I did. I used something like regular face paint. I actually went to a theatrical makeup store and kind of asked them what they thought was best and the easiest way for me as a makeup amateur.
How do you know which parts of your face need to be patterned?
The basic idea behind them is that you're trying to block an eye. You're trying to mess up the symmetry of your face because across ethnicities, basically there are certain patterns of light and dark that appear no matter what the base skin tone is, and mm-hmm. you're trying to throw those off. And you're also trying to obscure the region kind of between your eyes and the middle of your nose, your nose bridge, and then the corners of your eyes. My pattern relied on big fake eye marks on my cheeks and then a big swing of hair in front of my right eye.
You look slightly like some Disney character or something.
I heard it was like Flock of Seagulls, the cyberpunk version. but like, there's another pattern where you just take a big piece of black face paint and like run it to the middle of your eye all the way to your nose.
Hmm.
So you wind up painting the corner of your eye, and it's if it's dark enough, it winds up confounding the facial recognition software.
So you walked around, you rode around on the metro, you went and, you know, to lunch, visited a couple of places. Could you test whether or not it worked?
I could test whether or not it worked. Every iPhone, at least every iPhone, and most point-and-shoot cameras, and I think many Android phones, have facial recognition software built in. So if you pull out your phone and make to take a selfie, the yellow box that appears around your face is the phone's built-in facial recognition software, locating your face and focusing on it.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that I tested it when I was walking around and right after I put on the makeup was by just pulling out my phone and seeing if a yellow box appeared. And I was not usually successful. I would say I managed to not have that yellow box appear half of the time.
Well, how did people look at you when you were walking around with this flock of seagulls, cyber flock of seagulls look?
Yeah, you got a mix of reactions. So sometimes I just got people who stared. Sometimes I would say the most common one is I'd be walking by someone and their eyes would just kind of settle on my cheeks where I had these big fake eye marks. And they just stay there like as they walk by. And there'd be no social recognition that this is what they were doing. Like it was just so gripping that they kept paying attention. And of course, like, I am not the only one who in public space elicits this reaction. You know, there's lots of different kinds of ridiculous things you could do to your body, and people do them to get a rise, to get a public reaction like this. The main thing I learned from wearing the makeup is that the things that you do that hide you, that make you invisible to computer surveillance, make you incredibly visible to everyone else, make you like deeply memorable to everyone you walk by. And so there's not a way to hide from algorithmic and, you know, in-person surveillance. There's not a way to hide your face from both algorithms and, you know, people around you, unless you just wear a mask, which is very recognizable in its own right.
But if you explain to people that, you know, what you're doing, are they kind of like, yeah, you know, nudge, nudge, I believe that I'm being watched too. Isn't there a sort of, I don't know, dark conspiratorial sense?
There is. I think I found it hard to describe to people exactly why I was doing what I was doing when I was out and about. I would say because I was wearing the face paint because I found it interesting and because I found it visually arresting and kind of an interesting experiment. And I had to convey to people that I didn't think the government was reading my mind. This wasn't a tinfoil hat thing. This was to test the boundaries. Some people were into it. Some people just kind of were like, oh, okay. I found that if I told people why I was doing it honestly, I kind of got like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And if I told people that I was doing it because I hit a sports game or something, like my team was the black on your face team.
Rob Meyer, thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Robinson Meyer, associate editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about technology. You can see photos of him in his CV Dazzle makeup and read about his experience in the article he wrote for The Atlantic at wordofmouthradio.org. You'll also find more on our website, including instructions for Dazzle camouflaging your own face. Again, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, do you know all those anonymously posted photos of cats doing delightfully cute things? They may not be so innocent when it comes to giving away a pet owner's location. We know where your cat lives when Word of Mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. While some internet users consider protecting privacy online to be a mere suggestion, others take it very seriously. They track privacy settings on social media, erase cookies and browsing histories, and create dozens of passwords for frequently visited sites. And then they reward their vigilance by searching for adorable photos someone posted of cats doing cute things. But wait, it turns out that these little furry darlings of the internet are something of a Trojan horse. All those anonymously uploaded photos of little Whiskers stuffing himself into a tiny shoebox are giving away more than just adorableness. They are revealing locations. Owen Mundy is an artist, designer, and programmer who investigates public space and its relationship to data. He's assistant professor at Florida State University, and his latest project is called I Know Where Your Cat Lives. Owen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So, do you really know where people's cats live? How?
I do, and I know that because all that data is publicly accessible. It's all on the internet.
So what do you mean? Someone uploads something and it shows where they live?
That's right. When you photograph someone and you enable it in your software on your phone or your camera, the geographic coordinates are embedded in the metadata of the photographic file. And when you upload it, that data is stored in a database, and it's accessible by anyone with access to the API, which is the general public.
So what happens next? You go and search for cat photos and locate them, and you're putting them on a map, right? How many have you got?
I took a sample of 1 million.
And 1 million?
1 million cats. And this is from a larger sample that I could establish. There are at least 15 million photographs that are tagged with cat that also are public, that also include the geographic coordinates. So that's only a small sample of the actual number of cats in the world.
Right? How precise are those coordinates?
About 8 meters. So that's 20 feet. I can tell the difference between their backyard and their front yard.
I know you're an artist. I know you look at data and public space. Why are you doing this?
I mean, I'm interested in this because I was a photographer in the Navy, and I used to unload surveillance film out of jets on the aircraft carrier flight deck. And so many years later, I still have an interest in surveillance and media. And as an artist who works both with photography and data, I'm interested in how data visualization has a lot of the same baggage that photography did when it was invented. I was inspired to do this because I was photographing my daughter in the backyard, and one day I saw that there was a map button, and I said, what is this? I don't remember giving permission for all these photographs to be mapped, but there they were, all in my backyard of my three-year-old. And I thought, okay, this is weird. I need to translate this into a way that, you know, tells the story, that tells the facts, but also includes some information that allows us to think about this from different perspectives that are important to us as a culture.
So why use cats? I mean, are you trying to show people that something so innocent can contain so much?
Cats, in particular, are, you know, they're appreciated worldwide. They're domesticated. They're about as close as you can get to a child. And so I could have called it I Know Where Your Child Lives, but
that would have been
really
even creepier.
Yeah. And so I wanted to have some fun with it. I wanted to convey this idea, this kind of this important issue, to make people think about it, but, you know, to disarm it in a way, to make it fun, to encourage people to actually engage with it.
Oh, and if I understand correctly, if people, and the term is scrubbed the metadata from the photographs that they're uploading, they would not be located. Is that true?
That's true.
So is that difficult to do? Is it as easy as sort of unchecking the map feature on your camera or whatever you did?
That's right. So if you have an iPhone, and I do, so I know how to do this, you can go into the settings and you can disable geotagging for the camera. And so all of your photographs you take will not include this information.
So given that you have this map of this million cats around the world, if somebody saw a photo of their cat online and noticed that it was located to their neighborhood and, you know, wherever, could they request for you to take it down? And would you?
Yeah, the ironic part of this project is while I spent, you know, it's a really simple idea. And while it took me almost a year to download all the data, to create all the visualizations, which I use the FSU supercomputer for, or it's really a high performance computing cluster.
That's at Florida State where you teach.
That's right. And it took a lot of work to actually make the interface. And the irony of all of this work went into actually encouraging people to think more about the privacy and the data that they're sharing. And so it's really easy to remove your cat from the map. You just go back to Instagram or Flickr or wherever you're sharing those photographs through and increase the privacy settings on those photographs. And within 30 days, my app will automatically show, instead of the photograph of your cat and your house, it'll show another picture that says that the privacy settings on this photograph have been increased. Mm-hmm. So the end result could be that the success of my project could be measured by the demise of it.
It's the self-disappearing project.
That's right.
But you must have seen some really cute cats.
Oh my gosh. I told my aunt that when I started, I was not a cat person, but I'm about halfway there now.
Owen, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Owen Mundy, he's an artist, designer, and programmer who investigates public space and its relationship to data. He's also an assistant professor at Florida State University's Department of Art. His latest project is called I Know Where Your Cat Lives, and you'll find a link to look at it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, so Owen Mundy explained that you can erase the metadata that tags your location by changing your camera settings. Well, for full privacy protection, there's a little more to it. Sarah Plourd, NHPR's digital producer and designer, is the creative mind behind all those gorgeous and educational infographics on our website. She's also a photographer, which makes her our resident expert on EXIF metadata. Word of Mouth's Logan Shannon sat down with Sarah to find out what it really takes to erase metadata and started by asking, what the heck is EXIF metadata?
Well, it stands for Exchangeable Image File Format, which sounds very techy.
Yes.
Basically, it's just all the information that is stored about a particular file. So photos, videos, things like that, they store where you took it, when you took it, what your camera settings were, what your camera is, et cetera, et cetera.
That begs the question, should the average Instagrammer be concerned about removing metadata?
Well, I guess it depends on a number of factors. Are you hyper-concerned with your security online, and what are your photo storage needs? A number of social media sites, like the big ones, Facebook and Twitter, automatically by default strip all your metadata when you post a photo. There are others that are in sort of, like Instagram, are in sort of a gray area where it's not exposed to the user. So, you know, your cousin in Idaho isn't going to be able to see where you are at all times. But the information is still stored. So with a warrant, law enforcement could, you know, pull all the metadata from your photos if they're trying to track it. And then there are others like Flickr and TwitPic, which by default expose and store all your metadata, but you can turn that off.
All right. So this, we've been talking a lot about smartphones specifically, I think. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about Instagram, things that you typically are taking photos with your smartphone. But is that the only time metadata is stored is with a smartphone?
No, it's actually stored in most cameras too. So digital SLRs store some amount of metadata, and it depends on the model. So newer ones are designed, they have Wi-Fi built in, and some of them are designed for wireless upload. Those will store your GPS data, and you can turn it off. Older models just store things about, you know, the camera make, the model, and your aperture and shutter speed settings.
All right. So say you don't share your photos online. That's not something mm-hmm. that you typically do. Would there be another reason that it would be beneficial to remove the metadata?
Well, metadata takes up a lot of space. For your average, you know, parent who's got a new baby and they're taking hundreds of photos a day and they really want all these memories stored, just by storing metadata with their photos, they're cutting their photo storage in half.
Whoa. So that seems like a pretty good reason alone. Like yeah. right there, that seems like a pretty good reason. But is there a reason why the average person might want to keep it?
Well, there's a couple reasons. I mean, it does help you sort things. So you can go back into a photo and see when and where you took it, which may be helpful if, you know, you don't have a better organizational tool on your computer or what have you. But also if you're wanting to take better photographs, you can actually go in and say, hey, I like that photo. What was my shutter speed? You know, what were my camera settings? And you can use them to sort of teach yourself. Although ultimately, you're not going to be relying on that once you're a pro.
I mean, I'm not a super paranoid person. Not normally paranoid person, but it starts to make me think, I don't know mm-hmm. that I necessarily want people to know where I've taken these photos. So how hard is it to remove it? Is it something that you have to do manually, or is it each time you take a photo, or is there a way to sort of automate the process so that you don't have to do it every time?
Well, for location data, which is what you're talking about, it's only really the location data. It's very easy to turn off. You can turn it off in your camera. You can turn it off in your iPhone, on your Android. You just go into the settings and you shut that down.
Okay.
That way, when you take a photo, it's not logging in. And if you choose to share, hey, I'm on vacation in Vienna by yourself, that's great. But your photo is not going to say, hey, I'm in Vienna, go rob my house.
Yeah.
So, you know.
My photos say that all the time.
All the time. Now, for photos you already have, it's also pretty easy to strip out. There are a number of free shareware tools that you can download, or there are websites, but you can also just go in to the properties of your photos. You know, you right-click. Windows and Macs both make it really easy to just strip it all out at the same time.
Oh, so it's not a big deal. It's not yet another thing to add to my list.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for explaining this.
You're welcome.
It seems a lot clearer to me now. And we'll make sure that we have a link on our website to these basic instructions so that you can disable or remove your metadata as you see fit. Or if you want to just start, you know, maybe before you weren't sharing your metadata and now you're like, I want people to know where I am. This is how to do it.
I want to be easily stalked. Yes.
That's what we do here at Word of Mouth. We make it easy to stalk people.
Providing a service
yes.
every day.
Thank you for coming along today on Word of Mouth's exploration of digital privacy and other stories long kept secret. Earlier in the show, we heard about how strategically applied makeup and hairstyles can foil facial recognition software on surveillance cameras. To see a slideshow of some strikingly attractive examples of faces transformed by CV dazzle camouflage, visit wordofmouthradio.org. It's kind of cyberpunk meets Boy George and really interesting. Take a look and pass it along to your friends. After all, how do we learn to live in surveillance society if not by word of mouth? I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.